Hey, everyone, and welcome to the NFL Roadshow. Lindsay Rhodes here with 3 weeks remaining in draft season. The first round slated to kick things off on Thursday, April 28th. And we are going to continue our look into the prospects today with a deep dive into the defensive backfield. We're talking corners and safeties. Who are the best guys available? How are they different from one another? What makes them pop? Why might a team not want them? And who are the teams that should? We're talking fits. And also a little bit with regard to safety, value. Plus, my guest today, Eric Crocker, has an interesting favorite at that position. And it's a position that he knows well. He, defensive back in general, he played corner himself in the Arena Football League. He had a cup of coffee in the NFL, and he's carved out a really nice niche for himself as an analyst slash evaluator of that position in particular, and you'll see why in just a sec. He's very good. You can hear him on the Locked On Podcast Network, specifically Locked On 49ers and Locked On NFL Draft, and you can hear him here right now as we break the huddle.
Hello, let's go!
Two on two. Ready? Ready.
Crocky, it's good to see you.
It's good to see you too. Thanks for having me on again.
Thank you for being on again. I know that you've been very busy with your podcast talking all things draft. I would like to kind of narrow the focus for purposes of this episode to your specific area of expertise, which is the DB position.
My favorite thing to talk about.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. So how would you describe the cornerback? Let's start with the corners. How would you describe the cornerback class in general?
You know, I think it's a really good class. You have a little bit of everything. And I think that the maybe one of the biggest things I've noticed with this class is just the differences in the players. They have like these really different skill sets that it'll depend on what the team is looking for. Like say Sauce Gardner and Derek Stingley Jr. Derek Stingley, I mean, he was primarily a man corner at LSU, and they put a lot of responsibility on him from that standpoint, as opposed to a guy like Sauce Gardner, who he plays a man, but he also played a lot of zone, and you'd see them do some two high cover two type stuff. And just the way he played, just different body styles, different movement skills. So I think from that standpoint, throughout this class of cornerbacks, it's intriguing.
How is that transition? Like, what is that like from college to the pros, or even going from like one type of team that plays more zone than man? Is one harder or easier to make than others?
I think the transition can be more difficult than most fans know. Just a year ago, there were two guys, or 2 years ago now, I believe, there were two guys drafted in the top 10. Yeah, CJ Henderson and Jeffrey Okuda. Okuda mm-hmm. went number three to the Lions. Henderson went number nine, I believe, to Jacksonville, somewhere around there. Mm-hmm. Well, really, when they were drafted, I thought they should flip-flop. And not based on who you think is like the better guy, but more so what their skill set was and what they did well. Henderson, I thought, was the better pure man guy in that class. Whereas opposed to Jeffrey Okuda, was one of the better and one of the best guys to kind of read down concepts from a press bail zone type scheme. So I thought if you flip those guys, they would fit perfect. But when you ask Okuda to have to shadow guys and travel around and cover opposing wide receiver ones or different receivers, I didn't think that was a skill set. And he struggled with it. And then everybody comes out and says, oh, he's a bust. I knew he was overrated. And it's like, man, not really. He's just in the wrong scheme for him.
They just need to trade him.
Yeah.
Just flip-flop. How does that kind of a mistake get made?
Oh, man. You know, I think sometimes scouts or coaches just seeing the talent and saying, you know what, I can make him do this other thing, or I can put him here and I can teach him these other things, as opposed to just being like, you know what, this guy does this at an extremely high level. Let's just stick with that and have these other guys do things. A real quick example, Stephon Gilmore. I remember talking to a Patriot defensive back, and he talked about how Stephon Gilmore, they kept it very simple for him. Hey, you go guard that guy, and they would run zones and things around him, but they would leave him manned up because that's what he does very well. So, you know, so maybe it takes a coach to kind of get out of his own way and not be stubborn and not try to force a guy into a specific scheme. It didn't get the best version of that guy.
kind of hopping all over the place now, but since you brought up Gilmore and he is still a free agent, then based on what you just said, where do you think he would fit best?
So someone that runs a lot of man. You know, obviously, I think, going back to the New England Patriots, that would be a win. Now, I don't know why he wanted out. And obviously, there might be some things going on there in-house to where he won't return there. But I think a scheme that runs a lot of that type of coverage, two man, some they ran match man, which was like really weird to see on film. I didn't know what I was looking at first. But I'm trying to think of some schemes in the NFL. Probably the Lions, what they're doing now, is he going to want to go to a team that right. is potentially kind of rebuilding? Aaron Glenn, the cornerback coach there, they played a lot of two man when he was in with the New Orleans Saints. I think maybe, you know, bringing Gilmore to play opposite, maybe Okuda, that would be good. But then they have Aurier, who he had a strong year. So I don't know. We have to see where he fits, but definitely a scheme that runs more man.
I've heard his name in Raider circles a lot, that they're kind of hoping that that's a potential possibility. Does that make sense in any way?
Oh, I think it makes sense because definitely they need a lot of help at corner. But again, it's on the coach to adjust. So if you can say, you know what, maybe this isn't exactly what our scheme is and what we built our foundation around. But if we can tell this guy, hey, you go do that, and we can play around him a different kind of scheme, I think from that standpoint, it could be successful. Everyone just has to be on the same page.
While we're there, where should Honey Badger go?
Oh, you know, I think a great spot, 49ers. No, I'm a 49ers.
It says
fan,
the 49ers guy.
But, man, you know, I think, and when we get into the safeties, my top five safeties, there'll be some guys that have a similar type style as him. And
oh, I love hearing that.
But
Tyron's
very, very, yeah, I mean, very versatile. He can play different type of scheme where there's too high. He can play man. He can man up on slots. I think that gives him more value. I'm curious to see why he's kind of holding out right now. I don't know if it's a money thing, but a team that I think would utilize him the right way, probably the New York Giants with their new defensive coordinator and what he did in Baltimore. They ran a lot of man. Now, he put a lot on his cornerbacks, but I think if you had a safety like Matthew, you could utilize him in a similar aspect.
I wonder if he's holding out or if the teams are holding out on him based on what you just said about the guys in the draft class that have some similarities. Because if you could plug one of them in on a rookie contract for 5 years, why would you pay for Tyron Matthew? So maybe it's possible right. that he's just going to have to wait until after the draft. I don't know any information, but literally just based on what you just said, that would seem to make sense to a degree. Okay. Getting back to the cornerback draft class. Would you say that it's a particularly deep position, or is it like obviously tiered in terms of elite and then, you know, good, but not elite? Like how would you break it down in that sense?
I think the guys that are probably projected to go in the first 50 picks, you're strong there. And then it kind of tails off a little bit. Now, after that, there are some guys that have really high upside. And, you know, I guess I'll mention some of them right now. Tariq Woolen, a guy out of UTSA, cornerback, really long, 6'4", 205 pounds. I mean, ran a blazing 40-yard dash. But what people don't understand is, especially at the cornerback position, the taller and longer you are, the more difficult it is to actually like match and mirror the movements of a receiver. So I'm interested to see how he kind of develops and how he understands how to play with more anticipation. I spoke with him at a Senior Bowl. I actually advised him. I said, hey, go work with Antonio Cromartie. If you need me to set that up, he was my former teammate, I'll set that up. And I actually hit Cromartie. Cromartie said, anytime he's in Texas, I'll work with him. But work with a guy that understands your body, your movement skills, and how difficult it is to play at that length and learn how to play with more anticipation. So he's a guy probably later, but he has freakish upside.
Do you know if they ever hooked up?
I haven't seen it. And, you know, everybody posts everything on social media now. So I haven't seen it yet, but hopefully in the next few months, maybe some off-season training, they get connected.
It's a good point. If it didn't happen on Instagram, it probably didn't happen. Okay. Didn't so happen. I'm asking about the tiers because I'm trying to figure out kind of where the run would be. And if you think that there's depth and they all kind of merge together, if that might, you know, result in teams waiting to get guys later. So as we go through kind of your top fives, I'd be interested for you to kind of talk about, also put them into like where your breaks are. You know what I mean? Like this guy is way different and you got to go get him. And then my next guy is lower. Anyway, should we start with your, let's start with your one. Who's the best corner in the class?
I like Sauce Gardner a lot. Now, obviously he had the production, big time production, and not just from like, you know, a playmaking standpoint, but he limited the plays of opposing receivers that he had to go up against. I've heard some crazy stats. And I've fact checked it, but something along the lines of last year didn't give up more than 13 yards to any one receiver in the game. That's incredible. Zero touchdowns given up throughout his entire career. That's incredible. Now, we do have to use some context with it because, you know, he is a guy who did not play in the Power Five, right? So my next guy on the list, when I get to him, he played against much more talented receivers and prospects that are going to the NFL, top 10 picks, where you're going to get tested more than what Sauce did on a consistent basis. Now, Sauce did go up against Jameson Williams, who I think is probably my wide receiver one in this class at Alabama in that playoff game. But I thought they leaned a little bit more zone heavy than playing pure man and having him on an island, having to really focus on guarding this one receiver.
It seems like Sauce, and by the way, I know who your number two is based on what you already said, but we'll get to that. The fact that Sauce kind of checks every box, I feel like for me, as somebody who, you know, is not watching the tape and doing the evaluation, but just taking in all the things that I've heard from other people like you who are watching the tapes, it feels to me like I would be the most comfortable drafting that as my one, because there are fewer question marks attached to it. He's got the size, right. He's got the speed, he's got the swag, which is so integral at this particular position. If you're going to put somebody out on an island, and by the way, is he a guy that you would put out on an island? Is he a CB1? Because there's a difference in this class, I think. And some of the guys are very, very good CB2, right? Like, but that doesn't mean that they're not great. They just aren't necessarily the guy you want on a wide receiver one. Is he that guy?
I talked about scheme fits, and I don't know if he fits a pure man scheme that's going to ask him to be manned up a ton, but a team that I really like drafting him, and this is really high for a cornerback, but number three overall, the Houston Texans, who play more too high, Lovie Smith's defense, more cover two, that type of scheme, using his long 6'3 frame, getting in passing windows, still being able to play man and use his athleticism, I think that would be a great spot and really set him up for success. He does some really good stuff with his zone eyes and sometimes even man eyes as well, where, you know, I have this thing I call pressure key, visual key. I actually got that from Coach Howard, a guy I coach with, but pressure key, visual key in zone, right? Where a lot of times in zone, you're reading 2-1 and your pressure key is the guy in front of you. That's one. Your visual key is likely two or somebody that can leak out at a backfield. Well, Sauce Gardner did a terrific job of getting his hands on one, squeezing to shrink those windows, and then come off to make tackles on plays in the backfield. I thought his mindset and where he was from a physicality standpoint was really off the charts. So there's a lot to like about him, especially from his own standpoint. Man, I like him, but I think a more zone-heavy scheme, especially that allows him to line up and press alignment, that would be more ideal for him.
Houston makes so much sense, obviously, in terms of their areas of need, coming in dead last year in coverage grade, according to PFF, with an abysmal 32 was their coverage grade. For perspective, Cleveland was number one with a 90.7, and 21 teams in the NFL had at least a 60 or more. Wow. So obviously that is an area of need for them. There are lots of them, but I guess that's a good place to start, right? At corner, because that's an elite value position. Okay, so that's Sauce Gardner. Based on what you said earlier, I'm going to guess that your number two is Derek Stingley Jr.
Yes, and I don't know how confident I am, but I still think he's just a step above everybody else in the sense of the highs that I've seen from him. I kind of compare his situation like Trevor Lawrence, where Trevor Lawrence, freshman year, you know, like he probably far exceeded expectations, winning a national title, knocking off Alabama. And I know everyone said, well, he can only go up from here. He's matching everything that we thought we would see from him, the greatest prospect ever since Andrew Luck and all that stuff. And then I thought Trevor Lawrence's next 2 years were just kind of so-so. And maybe just the expectations were so high. I think it's the same thing for Derek Stingley, where he had such a great freshman year. And then after that, it's kind of been a little inconsistent. He's been banged up. He's missed games. But when you put on that freshman film and you see how well he played really throughout the year, I know he had his hiccups against Devontae Smith, who I thought was a terrific receiver. Actually had those hiccups 2 years in a row. But aside from that, I mean, when you talk about, you know, being a fluid athlete, being able to run with guys, being able to challenge guys at the catch point, when his technique is on point, is really good. From that standpoint, he's great. But how much did the injuries hinder him? And what can you expect, you know, kind of heading over to the NFL? How would that translate? Which version of Stingley are we getting? Right. I think that's the big question mark.
For me, that just scares me. And it bumps him down my list, regardless of what you might see. Like, I'm somebody who needs a high floor, right? Like, yeah. I might, like, you're looking for that very high ceiling, obviously. But I kind of feel like at least high in the first half of the first round, I want to draft somebody that I know their floor, where their floor is, and that I'm going to get somebody that I can count on to be something specific. And then if they are more than that, then obviously that's great. Where do you come in on, you know, on that argument, I guess? What would you be looking for? Why would a team want to roll the dice on him maybe early in the first round? Is it a specific type of team that can afford to do that?
Yes, there is a specific type of team, a team that has, I don't know, maybe three first round picks this year. And that would be the Philadelphia Eagles, where, yep. And I don't know if Stingley's going to, you know, go that late. But if he does, if he's there available at 15, a team that's like, you know what, we have three swings at it. If we miss on one of these guys, especially Stingley, who has elite capabilities, but maybe, you know, the consistency lacks in the sense of what we've seen over the last couple of years. They can take that swing, because as long as they hit on one of the other two guys, then they're just fine. So it makes a lot of sense for a team like that. That's also will need cornerback help as well.
That's a really good point. That's a really good point. Who's your number three?
Kyre Elam, cornerback out of Florida. He has the size. He has the speed. You know, you talked about the swagger that Sauce Gardner plays with. I think Elam plays with that as well. Watching him, I like to watch, and I watch several games on these guys. I really like to watch, like, the best competition they played against. And in recent years, like, I'd always go to the LSU film. Like, how did cornerbacks play against LSU and those receivers, Chase and Jefferson and those guys? Well, now it's been Alabama as well, whether it was, you know, the Waddles and all those guys, Ruggs, and Judy, and Smith. And this year they had Jameson Williams. And I like to see, well, how does this guy look playing against a guy that is so twitched up, so fast, so much burst and acceleration, and he handled it extremely well. I learned a lot about a cornerback based on how they react to a receiver. Does he bail on his technique because he's scared about being beaten over top? You know, does he, you know, get out too quick on certain things? You know, does he stay square at the line of scrimmage, or is he trying to run out? So I thought with Elam, he did an extremely good job of challenging himself at the line of scrimmage and not really falling for things that Jameson Williams was trying to give him. Competing at the catch point, I thought it was a terrific game. So showed really high upside from that standpoint. Then he went to the combine, ran very well, ran sub 4.44s. I think it was 4.38, 4.39. And with his size, I think that's tremendous. He's almost like a CJ Henderson clone who went top 10 a couple years ago.
Is he scheme specific?
I think they did enough to be versatile. I would still lean more man with him. I thought he just looked more comfortable at, you know, at the line of scrimmage playing press as opposed to off. But he is someone that can do some of those things.
I've heard people talking about his ability to flip his hips not being particularly off the charts. What do you see in that regard, and what do you make of it?
Yeah, so you're not going to want him to have, like, so coaches can do things to put guys in a position to where they don't have to turn and run from an off coverage standpoint. You want to simplify it as much as possible for him. So again, he's a guy who I would play more at the line of scrimmage, and that would eliminate him having to, you know, play off coverage, read his receiver down, flip his hips, turn around with a guy, you know, line him up more in press man or press bail and have him read concepts. From there, I think he'd be terrific.
What kind of a team? Where should we put him?
Oh, you know, I like Kansas City at the end of the first round. Mm-hmm. You know, they've been very aggressive with how they play their coverage. And he might go higher than that. But if we're just talking about a fit and a need for a team, I think KC, that's a perfect match for him.
So KC leaves the first round with a wide receiver and Elam?
You know, we'll see with the receivers because they did. Obviously, they traded Tariq Hill, but they signed Juju. They signed Valdez-Scantling, I believe.
Yeah.
And they also had the kid out of Georgia, Mecole Hardman. Mm-hmm. So they have some guys to where we'll see if they draft receivers. But
enough?
I don't know if it's – I don't know. What. And then you throw in Travis Kelce, who's the number one pass.
Obviously.
So when you factor all of those guys in together, I think that's a solid group where you don't have to force a receiver. Now, if there's a guy that you just really like and you're like, man, he's here and we didn't expect him to be here, you take him. But if they're not that guy, I don't think you have to force a receiver at pick 29 or 30 or wherever they're picking.
Well, Mahomes will – you know, elevate the play of any wide receiver. So maybe you're right. Maybe they can get away with that. Who's your number four cornerback?
All right. My number four is Andrew Booth out of Clemson. Now, this is a guy you talked about kind of scheme versatility. And he shows tremendous athleticism, being able to jump off the charts, at least on film. Now, one thing kind of scares me a little bit. He has not tested yet. And maybe it's some injuries or maybe he just keeps pushing it off because he doesn't want someone to see something. So that's a little questionable, but at least on film, you talked about having hips to be able to flip your hips, turn and run. He does that extremely well. Talk about what scheme does a guy fit in. I think he fits in any type of scheme that a coach wants. He is one of the more versatile corners in this class. He kind of reminds me a little bit, maybe not to the same extent, but I really liked Greg Newsome last season, last offseason. He was my CB2 in that class. And I see similar capabilities from Booth, just in the sense of movement skills and scheme versatility.
What do you think of his feet? I've literally heard people describe his footwork in diametrically opposed ways. Some people have said he has the best feet in the class, and then some people have said that his feet need work. Which one is it?
I like his feet. I didn't see anything, you know, he motored out. I think maybe he used consistently a little bit too much feet at the line of scrimmage, sometimes giving a little bit too much space for the receiver. I really like when guys, hey, don't create the space for the receiver. It's already hard enough to play cornerback position. We want to make the receiver work as laterally at the line of scrimmage as possible. I thought he could be a little bit more consistent with that. But even then, it seemed more times than not, he wasn't in like bad positioning to eventually make a play on the ball.
Okay, I'm going to throw out a number. You tell me if I should be concerned about it. He gave up 29 catches on 46 targets for 312 yards this past year.
I wouldn't say too concerned, you know, because an NFL team can say, you know what, how did he get beat on these things? Or maybe if we just don't do those things and we put him in a situation that better fits him, then he'll be all right. To me, it always comes back to that. How do you plan on using these guys? Because sometimes they ding guys for yards. So I'd have to see exactly how that is. But let's say CJ Henderson, for example, if you look at the numbers against him, against LSU and Jamar Chase, it looks crazy. But part of it was because there was a 60-yard touchdown. But on the 60-yard touchdown, he was lined up in the slot. The receiver, Clyde Edwards-Helaire, really ran in. They ran a pick on him. Chase wheeled off of that, and he runs pretty much untouched for a 60-yard touchdown. But those numbers go against Henderson. But I'm looking at it like, well, that's a pick play. So when it comes to his kind of the evaluation of the player, I'm not worried about that. Unless he was told, hey, if you see Chase in the slot and you see Clyde Edwards-Helaire on the outside and Chase is on the ball, know that pick is coming. If you didn't know that, then there could be some recognition issues. But overall, I wouldn't be too worried.
All right. Where's a good fit for him? Let's find him a team.
Oh, okay. I mean, when you're like him, and I think he is as scheme versatile as he is, I think you can fit in a lot of places. But, you know, obviously my 49ers, they don't pick first round, but he fit great in the 49 scheme where they don't ask guys to play a whole lot of press or a whole lot of man. They run a lot of quarters. I think he fit a quarter scheme extremely well. So whatever quarter schemes are out there in the NFL, maybe the New England Patriots. I don't know if they're in need for a cornerback, but he'd fit that extremely well.
So now since you brought up, you know, maybe putting him on a team with in a second round pick position, how many cornerbacks do you realistically think will go? And we're putting teams where we think, you know, they're good fits. That's not necessarily like where we think that they will go, or in teams, you know, sometimes pick people that we don't agree with the slotting. Anyway, how many first round cornerbacks do you think that there are in this class?
I think
actually
four.
Okay. Four that should be first rounders, or four you think like the way the board plays out will probably go in the first round?
I think four that should be first rounders.
Okay.
Where I'm very confident. So even with Andrew Booth, I have him at four on my CB5, Trent McDuffie.
Okay.
I think he would go ahead of Andrew Booth. I think there's a possibility of that.
Why is that?
I just think the way they played at Washington was very soft. And you have to dig really deep to find exactly what it is you're looking for, especially from a man concept. I thought he was terrific enough. He showed good feet. He showed good twitch suddenness. I thought he really helped himself by running well at the combine. I think there were a lot of comparisons to Byron Murphy, who played at Washington previously, but he ran slower. He was like shorter, but ran a 4.55. And you start to run in that range, you're kind of running yourself out of the first round unless you have really good length. Well, McDuffie doesn't have as much length as you like, but with him running in the 4.4s and having the good feet, having the good hips, having some of the change of direction, I think a team would say, you know what? We've seen enough of him in man coverage that we really like, even though we weren't seeing it consistently, or even though he wasn't playing against top tier receivers week in and week out, but he has a lot to work with, scheme versatility. I think he's a guy that could potentially go a little bit higher.
I'm going to let that Pac-12 slander just slide and not take it on head on.
Well, you said I got the USC jersey behind me. So, you know, I root for the Pac-12, you know, from California, but, you know.
I know.
Yes. It's been a little interesting over there right now.
Can he take on wide receiver ones, McDuffie?
You talked about having guys come in as CB1s and CB2s. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he's a guy that I would project to be a CB1, but would be a solid CB2. That's okay. How I project it.
So maybe if there's a team at the end of the first round in particular, if we're talking, you know, in that range that likes him, that might actually be his best case scenario, because those are going to be better teams with fewer holes. Maybe put him opposite somebody who's already legit on the other side. You know, what's funny, and I don't know how it changes the evaluation or your ability to make sense of what you're seeing. He had a pretty good corner on the other side, in Washington Kyler too. Gordon. So what do you make of that when you have, you know, two guys? I mean, obviously they're each individually doing their own thing in their specific assignment, but in terms of, you know, a quarterback being able to avoid somebody or whatever, what does that do to your evaluation when you've got somebody maybe equally good on the other side?
Yeah, I'm not as high on Kyler Gordon as some others. I know there's some people that have him as for sure a first round corner. There were people that were projecting him to run in the 4.3s. He didn't do that. I think he ran like low 4.5 at the combine. So that's not ideal. And the 40 yard dash is not the end all be all. There's one other guy who I kind of have like 5B. So I do want to talk about him. He didn't run a great 40-yard dash time at the combine. Your film ultimately is going to determine how people feel about your ability to run with receivers. But again, in that Washington scheme, you just don't get to see it a lot because of how soft the coverage that they play over there. So my next guy, which is Roger McCreary out of Auburn, I'm really high on him, but he has some things that scare me a little bit. I think just on the film, he should be a first-round guy. But man, this reminds me of Damon Arnett coming out, who off of film, I'm like, man, off of film, Arnett looks like a first-round guy. But based on his testing, he looks like a day two guy and late day two, maybe potentially round three. And it turns out the athleticism did kind of hurt him. Either it was that or his off-field stuff, trying to kill people or whatever he was doing. That was weird. But
never ideal.
But Roger McCreary, not ideal at all. Roger McCreary, I thought just from an ability standpoint, what he put on film, he had some of my favorite film to watch. He challenged himself. They played a ton of man. He was able to run with guys. You watch him against Alabama. I feel like in the Alabama game, he was targeted like 12 or 13 times. I mean, they threw it at him, but they had to because he's guarding Jameson Williams. He's guarding John Mechie. They're trying to run slot phase on him. He's defending that well. They picked him a couple of times and got guys out in space, you know, but just from everything that you want to see from corner, he had it. But he's not the biggest of guys, 5'11", 186. And that's fine. You could be slight. I'm not worried about that. But the short arms, that's definitely going to turn NFL teams off of him, and not just short. I mean, it's like historically short. It's like a 28-inch. Like the some teams like Seattle, they're notoriously known for 32-inch arm length, and they, if you're under that, they're gonna cut you off. You can get by with 31. Anything shorter than that, you know, the questions start popping up. When you're under 29, that's very alarming. They're sounding alarms. So I'm like, all right, that's fine. Just run Will. And maybe people will forget about that. Well, he went to the combine and ran a 4.55. Now, that doesn't match with what I saw on film. I saw him run vertically with guys from the slot, which is one of the harder things to do. But they're still, you know, they're going to look at what he tested at. They're going to look at his measurements and say that's not as ideal. Now, he did go to his combine. I mean, his pro day, excuse me. Did go to his pro day and run much better. Ran like 4.47. So I think that helped him. So a team that wants to make an excuse to draft him because they love his film a lot, that might help him a little bit. But that testing, I think it might knock him down and actually let a team maybe in the second round have a corner that ends up being one of their better guys.
It's you brought up the arms. McDuffie also sub 30. We talk about arm length a lot at tackles. I think maybe, you know, your average NFL fan is less familiar with why arm length is so important for cornerbacks. Why is that?
I think it's actually more important for tackles. I mean, those are guys that are trying not to let the defenders get into their chest, and you want to kind of keep them at the distance and, you know, the hand fighting and all that. At corner, I think it's a little overrated. Everyone thinks, well, if you have these long arms, you press better. But not knowing in the NFL, I'd say 75% of the time, you're not getting hands-on at the line of scrimmage. It's so difficult. These guys are quicker. They're more agile. They're more crafty with their releases. Unless it's just this big guy that's kind of a slower mover, it's really hard to consistently get hands-on. Maybe having longer arms helps, but I don't think it just helps you just be a better cover guy. So I think it's a little overrated. And that's coming from someone who had the long arms and understands, you know, how to utilize them, but and how it can disrupt receivers at times. But it's at the NFL level, it's hard to do that consistently.
Got it. You've mentioned the 40 times a few times, and I am still hearing a lot of people talk about 40s with regards to this position in particular, the cornerback position. In a day when we have, you know, GPS data and stuff like that, is it still as relevant? Rick Spielman made a point a few weeks ago on the podcast about why 40 times are important just in terms of comparative, like historical data. You want to be able to fill in all of the data points in terms of comps and stuff like that, so you have a better idea of what you're looking at. That makes sense to me. But if you're looking at it just in terms of evaluating whether somebody is fast enough or not, does it still matter to the degree that it used to, do you think?
No, I think the GPS definitely helps a lot. But again, like you said, the historical data that goes into it kind of shows guys that don't run as fast typically don't play as long. And I mean, they have a large sample size of guys who maybe aren't as successful. I think it was my guy, Mosher, who have put out this whole thing of cornerbacks who ran a 4.6 or slower. And like one of them worked out. I think it was like Tremaine Johnson, who ended up having, you know, a 7 interception season, played like 7 years. And even then, once he kind of lost another step, it was just over. It was done. So I think the speed isn't the end all be all. You just have to be able to play the position. But I think in kind of using myself as an example, I was a 4.55 type guy at cornerback. And I felt that. Like I knew that, you know, I had to play things a certain way because it was harder for me to consistently run with guys that were just flat out faster. Now, if you weren't faster than me, or if you were barely faster than me, then I was fine. But if you were much faster, I found myself doing those things I talked about Kyrie Elam not doing, you know, getting out too quick, getting too far upfield shoulder instead of staying on that lower hip, because maybe I didn't quite trust that I can run with this guy and track the ball in down the field. So I think that's where it hurts a little bit, just knowing that you kind of have that in your back pocket. But I do think the GPS definitely helps a lot.
Since we're talking about 40s, is this a good time to pivot over to safety and talk about Kyle Hamilton?
Yes.
What do you make of his 40s, which were not exciting?
No, I think at the safety position, more than anything, anticipation is very important. And if you show the ability to do that and play with anticipation and understand the concepts and be able to read those things and get a jump on it, you're fine. Now, here's what's not ideal about Kyle Hamilton. Not only did he run a slower 40, at the combine, it was like 4.59, and that was alarming to people. And then he went to his pro day, and everything coming out of there is 4.7 and 4.74. Now, that's one thing. But the more difficult thing is, and I talked about it with some of these longer guys, right? Like Tariq Woolen. When you are so tall, 6'4", like he is, and 220 pounds, your movement skills are longer. So now you, just off of that, even if he ran a 4.3, you still have to be able to play with better anticipation. But now when you're longer like that, and you don't run quite as fast, and you're as tall as he is, I think it just makes everything more difficult. And it might kind of hurt how people utilize him. Are they going to ask him to do some of the things that some of these other safeties could do? You know, and we'll get into that, some of the coverage skills and ability that these guys have. But I've heard, and I'm on my guy, Tony Pauline, all the time. I do this podcast with the New York Giants weekly. And he talks about him potentially being an outside linebacker.
Really?
And I won't go that far, but I could see how you potentially might want him to play a little bit closer to the line of scrimmage. You could do some things for where he's off. I don't know how much you want to put him in that position consistently. So I could be wrong, but the size with the slower speed, it is somewhat alarming.
Well, his versatility, you could look at that as a strength, right? The fact that you could just like move him if need be, unless you're moving him because you just can't get it done where he is, right? Like I've seen him described as somebody that could play everywhere but the defensive line, and as if that's a good thing. Do you believe that to be true? And do you think that you would potentially... Would you have to move him for negative reasons as opposed to like, you're great at everything and here's where we need you?
You know, that was the conversation around Isaiah Simmons a couple of years ago coming out of Clemson. Mm. Now, the difference is because they have probably similar size. Maybe Simmons was a little heavier, but Simmons also ran a blazing 40. He ran sub 4.4. He was a 4.3 guy, where Hamilton doesn't have that. So that's the part where, again, GPS matters more.
Right.
And maybe we could see some things, because I've seen some film where he's a far half safety and he gets all the way across field running with somebody, intercepts a ball diving out of bounds. And that's terrific. Now, in the NFL, will the play take that long to develop? Will the quarterback be late? Are the receivers faster than what you saw in that game or in that situation? Those are the things that teams are going to have to kind of be able to kind of judge, you know, and figure out where to put him. But he is a guy, I don't want to overthink it because of a 40-yard dash. He's right. A terrific prospect coming out. There are people that have him ranked as high as top five, but I wouldn't take him that high. And I talked about my favorite type of safeties. He's not that. Now, what I do think is just with his body and ability of what we've seen, I don't doubt that he'll be a good football player. I just don't know exactly how high I would take a safety where I think it's a little bit harder to play that brand of football with how wide open the passing game is in today's game.
It's tough because every time I see him, you know, like at the Lions at number two, I have positional value issues, I think, with that. And I know that you could, you know, make an argument on his behalf. I just have a hard time taking a safety and building around that. If you're a team that's high enough to pick, you know, or bad enough to pick there, then you obviously right. have a lot of needs. Just from a positional value standpoint, does it make sense at all to take a safety that high? And if not, where do you think it starts to make sense from a value standpoint?
You know, if you just say he's going to have the same type of production as he did in college and in the NFL, and you see the ability and you like all that, then it does make sense to take a safety that high because he can affect the game at all three levels. You know, whether it's on the back end, him being a two high guy, whether he comes up. And I saw one play where it was fourth and one. He was a two high safety. And at the snap, he shot down and made a tackle for loss. So, you know, if you value a guy that can impact the game in that many different ways and kind of clean up things that maybe other guys have troubles with, then from that standpoint, I think he is worth it because there's a lot of added value there. But it's just, are you going to get that guy? And yeah. and that's the question.
In terms of just to continue the roster building thought and playing out the Detroit specific, I guess, thing, because that seems to be where he is being plugged in a lot. If you're Detroit and you're trying to build this defense, they have coverage problems. We talked about Houston and how they were the worst graded team last year in that department. Lions were second worst with a 36 grade. Again, an awful comp compared to most of the league. But then they also were really way down there in terms of pass rush. Also with the 64.7, they were the fourth worst graded team in terms of pass rush. So in terms of building a defense, does it make more sense to go edge and start there? Or if you feel like, I guess you, if you think that, that he is the type of guy that changes things on the back end, I guess where is the most benefit in terms of starting? Because you could make an argument, obviously, that if the rush gets there, obviously that helps the guys on the back, but also if the back end can lock them down, then that helps the guys up front get to the quarterback faster. So it all works together. Where would you start?
Edge, 100%, or pass rusher. I mean, the pass rush helps the secondary more than the secondary helps the pass rush. Now, there will be times where, you know, you can get a coverage sack and things like that. But at the end of the day, you want a quarterback as uncomfortable as possible. You want to move him off of his spot. You want to make him feel like his time clock is sped up and he has to get rid of the ball before he wants to. So if I'm going, if I have to choose between the front and the back end, in the sense of valuing that and picking that in the top part of the draft, I'm definitely going with edge. And I don't even have to think about that. Like, you move that quarterback, make him have to throw before he wants to, especially in this class where there are those edge guys. I think last year, you know, maybe there wasn't that, you know, pure edge guy in the top 10. This year, you got like five of them. So take one of them.
Who do you like the most for Detroit? Like, let's say, I assume you have Aiden going number one.
I believe he'll go number one in Jacksonville. Yes.
Okay.
So but he's not my favorite.
Oh, he's not. Oh, that's very interesting. Okay. Then, so assuming that that is what happens, then the draft kind of starts at two. And then who is your favorite? Who would you have them take?
So my favorite, I don't think he'll go here because he just ruptured his Achilles, but I love David Ojabo. And I love like his motor, his speed off the edge, the different pass rush moves he can give you. There's still some refinement going on there. But I just, when you watch that acceleration, and he looks like a clone of prime, like D Ford, like how D Ford, when he was really good for the 49ers or really good for Kansas City. Now, we only saw 2 years of that, but he looks like that coming off of the edge, the impact that he made. He can improve in certain areas, but if we're talking about getting after the quarterback, I think he's going to cause hell for quarterbacks. Now, he ruptured his Achilles, so I don't know how far he'll fall. Talked about Philadelphia Eagles maybe being able to take on a guy that is injured because they have three first round picks. Talked about Stingley potentially going there. Maybe a guy like Ojabo goes there as well. But I think so far he's like my favorite. And I know he had the injury and people think that this season is over for him, but it's not. Like most guys with this injury, they come back 6 to 7 months. So he'll come back later in the season. It's good that it happened for him in March. Come October, November, he could be full go. Now, he still won't be 100% himself, but I think for a team pushing to make a playoff run, and maybe that's not the Lions or could be the Eagles, though, he would help in that situation. You have him come in, hey, just be a third down guy coming off of the edge later in the year. I think it can help a lot. So he's probably my favorite guy because he does some freakish stuff.
I love that. And it totally makes sense
the
Eagles.
I was trying to watch Vincent Gray. He was a cornerback from Michigan. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't, who is that? Dang, it's Ojabo again. Whoa, who is that? Dang, it's Ojabo again. I mean, it was pretty cool to see.
So then we still haven't found anybody for Detroit. Who would you plug in there?
I think maybe a guy like Trevon Walker out of Georgia. He's very versatile. I think he could play inside. I think if you're running a 3-4 defense, he could play in there. If you run a 4-3 defense, he could be a 4-3 in. If you run a 3-4 and you want him to be an outside linebacker, he can rush the passer and drop in the coverage. There are the Goldston things going on where a guy that maybe didn't have quite the production, but tested through the roofs. And we're seeing that with Walker. But I just think a guy with so much upside, You got to find out if you feel like he can do those things, then you take him. If you don't think he'll ever be that guy and he's just a workout warrior, then you pass. But I think he's a guy that would fit really just the mindset of what Campbell is built in there with how he has his guys playing. I think Walker is that guy.
Did we find a team for Hamilton before we move on from him?
No, we did not. But I would take him out of the top 10. Okay. And I'd say maybe Houston with their second pick and a team that does run a lot too high and maybe won't ask him to have to come down, play man on slots, maybe, you know, do those type of things. I think he'd fit in a scheme like that. He can still run some cover three and be a seam flat guy. But I don't want him to have to play a whole lot of man or a whole lot of match.
Dude, you give them Sauce and Kyle Hamilton. Can you imagine how excited Houston Texans fans would be walking out of this draft?
Yeah, now I think they have some edge issues as well. So they might be upset with me that I didn't address that. But, you know, if you get better on the back end like that, again, Lovie Smith, you're working to build that defense and to your identity. And, you know, they're trying to piece up some other spots there with guys like Desmond King bringing him back. But I think having Sauce and Kyle Hamilton, I mean, that's you got some guys that you're really building on for years to come.
I mean, they're looking to build up everything. This is a team that's like the opposite of the Browns last year, where they could just take best available because they didn't have any holes on paper. Yeah. The Texans have holes everywhere, so they can also take best available. All right. So we've kind of talked about Kyle Hamilton in the ways that you don't necessarily agree with the way that everybody else is like gassing him up to the degree that they are. He's still your number one safety, though, correct?
No, he's technically my number two.
Who's your number one?
Lewis Cine out of Georgia. Love his film. I mean, and I have some of my notes here, but his closing speed. And again, this is not just because he ran a blazing time at the combine, another guy that ran in the 4.3s. But when you just watch him on film and how he can close on receivers or runners, it's terrific. And not just that. He doesn't just close and, okay, I'm going to go make the tackle. He closes and he throws his entire body into guys. And I saw it several times. Now, one time he kind of lost. He tried to take on Brian Robinson up high in the Alabama game and kind of, it was a collision. Then he kind of got driven back just a little bit. But then he made up for it on the goal line. Boom, came in there, tried to knock his head off. I love his tenacity. I love his mindset. They did a lot of stuff. You talk about match, you know, whether it's cover four or whatever it is. And him basically being manned up with receivers with a head start running at him, never panicked, got in phase, head around, made plays on the ball. I mean, he fits everything that I think you need to be in today's day and age as a safety.
So you like him more than Hamilton. Do you think there's a chance that he goes higher than Hamilton?
I would take him higher. I don't know how the NFL sees it. But I'm also a little bit lower on just longer defensive backs, typically, unless I can figure out a way to scheme around it. So if a team feels like they can scheme around the length up, like Sauce Gardner, I really like him. I put him in the scheme where it's like, hey, cover two. You can run some man, but we're not going to live in man, you know, just for his movement skills. I think that would be terrific. Hamilton, put him in the scheme, cover two, two high safety. Do some stuff where you drop down, play zone in space. I think you can do well there. You know, I think Lewis Cine, I just think he has more versatility because you can do some man stuff with him, match, and it doesn't matter the coverage that you run from a zone perspective.
You've mentioned a few times, and there seems to be a trend in the NFL moving toward more of a two high safety defensive look. Yeah. Do you think that that helps the guys coming out this year at the safety position, that teams are going to be maybe looking for more safeties than they have been in years past?
Yeah, well, I think they're going in more too high, and you're seeing a lot more quarters being ran. You have guys from that Kubiak, Shanahan offensive style where they're doing a lot of play action with the big crossers coming across the field. And they used to have more single high. You saw the Seattle 3 be really big in the NFL. In previous years. But now that crosser kind of screws up people's roles and leaves a big open window. So teams are going more, especially early downs, more towards a too high look so they have somebody to catch that crosser. I think from that standpoint, you see a little bit more too high going on, especially early downs. Now, third down, that money down, teams are playing a little bit more man, where there's more man with a single high or whatever. But you also want a bigger end on the edge to kind of really help against the run in that situation. So I think that's why I talk a little bit more about too high. You're seeing a little bit more in the NFL now, and even teams that don't traditionally run that type of coverage, they're doing it. But I think a team, you talked about Lewis in, I think a team that would fit, they got Nasir Adderley, but maybe the Chargers. I think the Chargers could fit. Now, again, that's kind of high. I think they pick like 16 or 17 in that range.
Yeah,
but 17. I think they would, 17, yeah, he would fit there. And then, again, if you pair that with what they have on the front, you got Bosa, they just got Khalil Mack. Think they're terrific, you know, linebacker position, the corners, they get, just got J.C. Jackson. Oh. I got Adderley, but if you throw like Lewis Cien in there, yeah, that's money. And you need that because you also got to play to your division.
Yep.
And they play in a division that now has Russell Wilson, also has Patrick Mahomes, of course, and everything that they like to do. So I think he'd be a good fit for the Chargers.
Also have Derek Carr and Davante Adams and that passing game there. I'm not going to let you just leave them out.
I know, my bad. My bad, Las Vegas.
All right, so we've got our number one and number two safeties. Who's your number three?
It is Jaquan Brisker out of Penn State. One thing that was really clear to me, watching him, one, very versatile. I feel like you can watch four plays and see him lined up in four different spots. So that's really good. They trust his ability a ton. He was very active. And I mean, whether he thought it was a pass or they do a play action, he go deep, then he come up. One of my first notes is searching for contact. So he's a guy that he goes out of his way to try to hit a guy or throw his body. Whether you're wrapped up or not, he's coming over the top to clean you up. He's searching. I really liked his mentality. Again, talked about it earlier, guys that play with swagger, he definitely has that. I don't know if it's because he's wearing number one. Well, I feel like when you wear number one, you have to play with a certain level of swagger. He definitely matched that. And I thought one of my last notes on him, his play recognition, I thought it was terrific. Just truly understanding right away what it is and being able to trigger and having the athleticism to play. Here's a guy that I thought did a really good job on passes going down the field, helping coverage, helping with the over-the-top coverage with defensive backs. So, yeah, here's a guy I really like.
PFF's draft guide says that he'll be specifically coveted by teams who have specific box roles.
See, I mean, I talked about seeking contact and he has that mentality, but I didn't see him as a guy that just has to. There was one play where I just saw him trigger so fast on a pass and almost pick it off. So he has aggressive eyes. It was like on the right sideline and he saw it, put a foot in the ground, got there, went to knock the ball away. I think he can play well in space as well as around the line of scrimmage or in the box role.
Where are we, by the way, in the draft now? Like in terms of like, we're going through your top five safeties, but it strikes me that like at cornerback, there are more high level elite talents in terms of where they're going to go in the draft at safety. Where is there a drop off? How do the tiers work here?
I think we'll see two safeties go first round, probably Lewis Cien, probably Kyle Hamilton, but then we also might see a team that might like someone more than the other. So maybe a team likes Brisker more than Lewis Cien. And so you could see that safeties traditionally just, you don't see a whole lot fly off the board in the first round.
Right.
So I project two.
Okay.
I bet the over-under on safeties being drafted would be set at like 2.5.
Okay. All right, cool. What about who's your number four and who's your number five?
All right, number four, we have, look at my notes here, Daxton Hill, who's one of my favorite guys. And I don't even know if he's going to be listed as a safety.
Right.
He played so much nickel.
Yeah.
But he has that physicality. There was one play I was watching him against Indiana, I believe it was. And he's matched up. He's manned up in the slot. He runs extremely well with a slot fade, takes it away. You see the quarterback look. It's not there. So then the quarterback takes off. And he's scampering for about 15 yards, 20 yards. And you see Daxton Hill, who's guarding the receiver, turns, sees the quarterback running at him, big quarterback, 6'5", 215. And he doesn't even think about it. He runs into him full speed. And for a guy to just have that type of mindset, like, you're tough. You ain't no punk out there on the field. So he's a smaller guy in stature, but he ran extremely well. Another guy that ran sub-4.3. There seemed to be a lot of those guys in this class. Probably the fastest class ever in the history of the combine. But think the versatility of him, being able to play nickel, match. I talked about Tyrann Mathieu. This is a guy that has that type of ability.
And your five?
And my five is Jalen Petrie. Now, he's a guy that was predominantly more in the nickel spot. And I'm curious to see how the NFL views him. Played well there. I thought he had fluid hips, was able to make plays on the ball. I was able to see him up close and personal at the Senior Bowl week, watched him all week. Thought he did a terrific job there. They played him more in the slot as well. Did some stuff where they had him play some man on the outside. They did that with a lot of the safeties. I thought he held up well and had a strong week. I don't think he's a guy that's going to go in the first round at all. Mm-hmm. But if a team, you know, you start getting around pick 50 to 60, I think his name might start coming up. Reminds me a lot of what's his name? Chauncey Gardner Johnson. There we go. Got drafted to the Saints coming out of Florida. He was a guy where it was like, is it a safety? Is it a nickel? The Saints have utilized him extremely well in that nickel type role. I think he can be that type of defensive back.
How do you know where you should use him when they're one of those guys that's almost like a tweener in terms of corner safety?
I think, again, you try to look at what they did well. Why did Baylor use him in that role to the extent that they did? And they did a lot of match stuff. I didn't think he was asked to play a whole lot of man. It was like, you know, he would take away one side, and then if a guy ran to that, then he'd run with it. I thought they simplified it for it, but I like the hips. I like the fluidity. I like the playmaking ability. I like the way he was able to make plays on the ball. So all those type of things let me know. Like, I think he is more suited as a nickel. I would be curious to see if somebody says, all right, maybe he profiles more as a nickel, or that's what we saw, but we'll put him at safety. And, well, if he can do those things, then he definitely plays safety. We saw that with Javon Holland, right? Javon Holland did a whole lot of that at Oregon, but then all of a sudden, you know, he goes to Miami, and they use him in different ways, even as, you know, two high, single high, and all those type of things. And I thought he had a terrific rookie year. A lot of people aren't talking about what Javon Holland did for Miami Dolphins.
Going back to the cornerback position, there's this guy, Zion McCollum. Are you familiar with him?
I watched him at the Senior Bowl.
Okay.
And I actually, you know, crazy thing is, I went to one of his games. Sam Houston played against University of Central Arkansas. And I trained a kid since he was in high school that plays for Sam Houston. So I went to the game. I didn't notice Zion McCollum there. Now, obviously, you go to the Senior Bowl week, you see him out there. He's a guy that tested extremely well, but I didn't quite see that at the Senior Bowl. I saw guys getting behind him. Now it's man coverage. It's a lot harder to guard there, but I just thought too much. He wasn't maybe trusting his speed enough. I thought he could have trusted his speed a little bit more, but that small sample size, because that's just 1 week against a different type of talent that he's used to covering.
So the tweet that I saw making its way around was about his relative athletic score, which I'm not actually particularly familiar with as a metric. Can you tell me about that and why? So he scored a 10 out of a possible 10, which ranked him number one out of the 1,923 cornerbacks that have come out since 1987. I'm trying to figure out what I should make of this.
I wouldn't make too much of it. I'd be curious to know where, like, Marco Wilson was last year. I mean, he tested through the roof and he ended up going fourth round, and Marco was solid. He had to play a lot as a rookie. I think he's a solid cornerback, but I don't think it was like, oh man, like you tested through the roof, so now you're just CB1 on this team. I don't think it translates quite like that. You got to trust your speed if you have it. And I don't know if Zion McCollum, I don't know if he's quite trusting it just yet, at least from what I've seen. But again, small sample size.
Is this the kind of thing that somebody could fall in love with late, in terms of, we've talked a lot about, you know, coaches and people being like, I can do something with that, you know, and trying to project it, even if they 100%. Haven't seen it on tape.
Or at the very least, know that they get someone that could potentially be a special teams ace. And NFL teams value that, I think, a lot more than the fans.
And there is value in that. Totally. Yeah.
I wish I was better on special teams. I might still be playing in the NFL.
Crocky, you're good at what you're doing, my man. This has been really, really good. What else do you feel very strongly about before I let you go about the draft, just in general, maybe even outside the DB position?
Oh, man. I think the receiver class, I think it's going to continue to get stronger each year. I think it's very deep. I mean, We'll see where, like, George Pickens goes. But that's a terrific guy who maybe a couple years ago you would have said would be the first receiver taken whenever he's able to come out. He's had some injuries, some setbacks, but he went to the combine. He tested well. You know, he's a guy that terrific contested catch guy. He's a guy that I think knows how to run routes well with pace and setting up defenders and using their leverage against them. I think there's a lot to like about him. I'm curious to see where he gets drafted. I don't know if that's a strong take, but I mean, there might be people that have him the eighth best receiver in this class. And that just kind of shows you how deep of a class it really is.
Which of these wide receivers would you least like to have to go up against?
Oh, that's a great question, because that's how I kind of view receivers. Probably, probably Jameson Williams.
Okay.
Because he's just so twisted up. And I watched him against Arkansas, and there was a play where he ran kind of this, like, it looked like almost like a slant and go, but it was kind of like a kind of a dig and go type thing. And for him to have a corner playing over the top and the safety playing over the top and them not even bite on his in-breaking move before he went up, and him still not only outrun both guys, but catch behind them and then run both guys out of their form. That's how you know a guy's fast. If you see the DBs kind of run out of their form and score a touchdown, I don't want to guard that guy.
Crocky, you're the best. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me on.
Good dude. Good info. Go give him a follow at Eric_Crocker on Twitter. I wanted to circle back on the point of positional value that I brought up about the safety position and Kyle Hamilton specifically, since he's going really early in a lot of mocks. So I wanted to clarify the point that I was making there is, yes, tied to the value of the safety position in the NFL in general to a degree, though I do think that that's actually going up with the two high looks that we're seeing and building around more frequently now. But mostly what I meant there was literal value, as in the finances of drafting a safety in that position. And I wanted to explain what I meant. So as you know, I'm sure, rookie salaries are pre-negotiated and set according to draft slot. So the first overall pick gets a four-year contract worth $41+ million. The 16th overall pick gets a four-year deal worth $16+ million. And the 32nd is slotted at a four-year deal worth $12.4 million over the course of those 4 years. So if Hamilton goes to Detroit, he is slotted to get a $39.6 million contract. That would, as of right now, be the eighth richest contract in the league for a safety before he's even played a down. Average annual value of that contract would be $9.9 million in that range. That would be the 13th highest in the league. It would be more than two of last year's all-pro safeties are going to make this year. Well, are currently making on their deal, I guess, in terms of average annual value. Derwin James, who makes $3 million a year, has a roughly $12 million contract that he's playing on. And Jordan Poyer, who makes $9.75 million a year, he's on a two-year deal. So by contrast, and this is a really important part of this point, the two all-pro edge rushers last year are on contracts in the $100 million range that pay $28 million a year in the case of TJ Watt and $25 million for Myles Garrett. So if the Lions drafted an edge in the two spot and that guy turned out to be the guy that they're hoping he'd be, i.e. very good, they would get a massive discount at the position for the next 5 years, paying that guy $9.9 million dollars a year for the first four with an option, you know, to add on the fifth year. This is obviously what Washington did in the case of Chase Young and what San Francisco did in the case of Nick Bosa. And that is why those two players are currently 34th and 35th in terms of average annual value at their position. Clearly, they are not the 34th and 35th best edge rushers in the NFL. So those two teams are getting massive breaks on their salary and getting these game-changing players at a really cheap price. That affords the team an opportunity to put other pieces around them during that time frame. That's what I'm talking about here. Not that Kyle is not going to be good enough to live up to that value. It's that there isn't as big of a difference or really any, in terms of the pay scale, if you draft a safety there, he's automatically going to get paid really, really high. So if you go get him, as opposed to getting a top of the market guy in free agency, you're not getting a break. And he's never stepped foot on the field, and you don't know if he's going to be good. So there's no added benefit for you to get him unless you're just incredibly desperate. In the case of, again, Detroit or Houston picking at number three, they both could use an edge rusher. It just doesn't make sense to me to start with a safety and not get that break in pay at the position because, again, if you're Detroit and you are looking for an edge rusher, let's say, where are you going to get that guy? How are you going to get him? So you don't get him through the draft. You don't get the break in value. Are you going to go pay somebody $100 million to bring them in free agency next year? It just doesn't totally make sense to me if you have this opportunity to get somebody in a very good edge class, as, of course, you heard Kroenke say. I realize sometimes we talk about positional value and stuff like that without fully clarifying what it is that we're really talking about, so I thought it might be worth it to backtrack a little bit and walk through it. But again, like Eric said, for a team like Detroit that has needs everywhere on a defense, even if money wasn't the issue, I think I'd bang the table for an edge in that spot rather than a safety. But maybe they see Kyle Hamilton differently, specifically as a guy who could walk onto the field and make a difference for the entire defense right out of the gate, enough to warrant one of the best contracts for his position. And also as a generational Ed Reed, Troy Polamalu type, maybe, that you can build a defense around. I think that that is what you would have to be talking about in order to take him there. And then again, not to, you know, belabor the point anymore, even if that were the case, I just don't know if it's the smartest team building strategy. Anyway, moving on, we'll find out what Detroit thinks. We'll find out what Houston thinks. I'd love to hear what you think about the subject, Kyle, the position, all of it. You can hit me up on Twitter at Lindsay_Rhodes. I'm also on Insta at LindsayRhodesNFL. I have strong thoughts and feelings about the subject matter, but I think I'm open to have my mind changed. So, you know, take a swing. That's going to do it for us this week. Thank you so much for listening. As always, this is the part of the show where I ask you to subscribe, rate, review, all of the things, and also where I thank the people behind the scenes who make this show possible. That is Andrew Emmer, who produces the show, Marissa Rivas, who is the acting director of sports podcasts for SiriusXM, and Steve Cohen, the SiriusXM senior vice president of sports programming and podcasting. The NFL Roadshow is part of the SiriusXM podcast network, and we'll be back next week with another episode. Have a good one.
SiriusXM Podcasts.